Good afternoon and welcome to COSO at 30 Years, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Mark Beasley, Deloitte Professor of Enterprise Risk Management and Professor of Accounting and the ERM Initiative Director at North Carolina State University, and I'm moderator for today's program. 3 decades ago in 1985, 5 private sector organizations, the American Accounting Association, the American Institute of CPAs, Financial Executives International, the Association of Accountants and Financial Professionals in Business, and the Institute of Internal Auditors formed a joint initiative to sponsor the National Commission on Fraudulent Financial Reporting, which is commonly known today as the Treadway Commission, in recognition of its original chairman, James C. Treadway, Jr., who was the executive vice president at that time and general counsel of Payne Webber and a former SEC commissioner. The report of the National Commission on Fraudulent Financial Reporting was issued in 1987, and a copy of the report is available in the collection of the Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation at www.sechistorical.org. Since then, the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations of the Treadway Commission, widely known as COSO today, remains dedicated to providing thought leadership through the development of frameworks and guidance on enterprise risk management, internal control, and fraud deterrence. Today's program will look at COSO's work and impact over the last 30 years. Joining with me today are David Landsittle, a COSO chairman emeritus. Dave began his career with Arthur Andersen and Company and served as chairman of the AICPA's Auditing Standards Board. We also have Larry Rittenberg, who also is a COSO chairman emeritus, whose service preceded Dave's. Larry is professor emeritus of accounting at the University of Wisconsin. And we're finally also joined with Richard Steinberg, founder and chief executive officer of Steinberg Governance Advisors, Inc. Rick led the development of 2 COSO landmark reports, the Internal Control Integrator Framework and then the Enterprise Risk Management Integrator Framework, both recognized as standards for effective internal control and risk management. COSO has partnered with the SEC Historical Society and its virtual museum and archive of the history of financial regulation for this program and to add to its materials to the museum's collection. The Virtual Museum and Archive is the preeminent source for trusted and verified information and material on the regulation of the capital markets and will welcome more than 2 million visitors this year. The Society and the Museum are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no public funding. The museum is exhibited independent of any SEC oversight. The Society is grateful for the generous support of COSO in making today's broadcast possible, and thanks to Robert Hirth, the current COSO chairman, for all his efforts in helping to record and document the history of COSO. So let's begin with the history of COSO. We naturally want to start with a little perspective of where COSO began. So, Dave, I'm going to turn to you and see if you could sort of give us a quick thumbnail of what some of the events that were in place that triggered the need to bring these 5 organizations together back in 1985. And sort of if you can give us a sense for what the vision was, if you can recall, when it was created.
Thanks, Mark. Back then, there was an emerging concern about an increase in the incidence of fraudulent financial reporting. And I was recently completed a term as chair of the Auditing Standards Board, and we had that concern as it related to auditing standards. But importantly, there was a concern and a recognition that we needed a broader perspective of all the stakeholders that were involved and might be affected by fraudulent financial reporting. So that triggered the idea of getting the 5 sponsoring organizations together to sponsor, as a private sector initiative, the Treadway Commission. So the vision of the Treadway Commission was, I think, 2 related aspects. One is to identify the causal factors that lead to fraudulent financial reporting, and secondly, to identify steps and provide recommendations to help reduce the incidence of fraudulent financial reporting.
And those recommendations were to a variety of bodies, right? Like,
that's correct.
Academics, which I'm one. SEC,
that's correct. The final report had recommendations that dealt with the auditor, the preparer, the regulator, research, and the educator. So it tried to recognize the importance of the involvement of all the stakeholders that might be involved in fraudulent financial reporting.
Right. And Larry, you know, can you give us your sense of when you assessed that Treadway Commission report? It came out in 1987, I believe. What was your sort of take and how it addressed those challenges that Dave mentioned in really deterring fraudulent financial reporting.
Yeah, when I think about it, Mark, a couple of things hit my mind. First of all, when I was even younger, we talked about fraud, but it was always fraud within a company. And as we learned at the period that David was talking about, that companies could enrich themselves by reporting fraudulent financial information. So, first of all, I think it clarified the difference between fraudulent financial reporting and just other kinds of fraud. And that led to a lot of academic research. It led to changes in practice. It led to changing how we educate future generations of auditors. I think the other thing that was instrumental is that they recognized that we needed a new approach to looking at internal controls. Fraud is a major risk. We have to address that risk. We need a more comprehensive view of internal control, which led us to start thinking about better governance, things like the control environment, things like tone at the top. And that led to the recommendation, among many others. And I think we should recognize that the Treadway Commission's recommendations were broader than just the internal control framework. I'll talk a bit about that later. But it led to the work that Rick led us on in developing the comprehensive, integrative framework for internal control over financial overall, not just financial reporting.
Yeah, yes. All kinds of objectives. So that had a major that came out in 1987, and as you were mentioning, that real focus on governance and controls was followed in COSO's history. We move into 1992 when COSO released this internal control integrated framework that you refer to. That framework represented one of the first, if not the first, sort of principles-based frameworks for management and others to use when designing and implementing internal controls. Dave, can you give us a little more color on what motivated COSO to think of, okay, we need a framework. We need to develop something like that.
Yeah, well, first of all, as Larry said, the group that spearheaded the development, and Rick obviously was chief among that group, recognized that there needed to be a base pronouncement that people could look to as to what constitutes effective internal control. So, for example, the Auditing Standards Board had pronouncements that dealt with internal control. The Institute of Internal Auditors had pronouncements that dealt with internal control. The FEI, there was academic research that related to internal control. But there was no single source that somebody could go to as a benchmark as to what constitutes effective internal control, and that was the heart of the Treadway recommendation, to have that single source that somebody could look to and a broad source that was principles-based. So the idea was, once we have that source, it would help public companies judge the effectiveness of their internal control systems and hopefully make improvements to their system that would, among other things, lead to the reduction of the incidence of fraudulent financial reporting.
Mm-hmm. Coming out of that Treadway sort of focus on
right.
reporting. So, Rick, you were obviously playing a major role, and we want to hear a little bit more about that, but could you give us a sense for some of the key players that were involved in this project? And in a lot of ways, you were starting with a blank screen. Who was involved, and then what were some of the key challenges that you were having to deal with to get this concept to reality?
That's right, Mark. And I'll talk about the key players. And I'd like to name names because they were so important to the success of this project. It starts with the COSO board, of course, and it initiated and sanctioned the project. Those people were Bob May of the AICPA, Al Ahrens of the AAA, and excuse my acronyms, Bill Bishop of the IIA, Tom O'Toole, IMA, and Norm Roy of FEI. And then there was the advisory council, which was very important to the project, with senior executives to such companies as IBM, AT&T, Shell Oil, Household International, an academician, and a senior audit firm partner. And those names, just quickly, Galen Larson, Andy Bailey, Roger Carolus, Perry Caldwell, Bill Eilenfeld, Dave Landsettel, who, of course, is on this broadcast, John Stewart, and a consultant to the council, which was Howard Sears. And it really provided very important insights, guidance, and oversight. In terms of Coopers & Lybrand, there was the deputy chair, Vin O'Reilly, and Frank Tanke, the head of the technical services of the firm. They were really oversaw the project. And as you mentioned, I led the core project team, which was designed to develop the framework. And that was supported by a couple of partners, Bob Schwartz and Bob Spares, and really many, many other Coopers partners and managers who were involved in the project. I think it's important to know that there were hundreds of others providing input to the project. We talk about a cast of thousands. There were over 1,000 people involved in the form of interviews, responses to questionnaires, workshops, public exposure, field testing. And those were with CEOs and board members and legislators, regulators, all providing input. And the core team also set up an advisory group to bounce ideas off of, and we engaged several academicians. The point being, there was a broad involvement of a wide array of knowledgeable and experienced individuals and organizations. Now, Mark, you asked about some of the challenges, and there were certainly many. And as you said, we did basically start with a blank screen, although we had good conceptual knowledge of the core team, the core team did. And some of the issuances that David just mentioned from the AICPA and SEC and Treadway itself and so forth. But really, a good deal of thought and creativity had to be brought to this development effort. And then, as significant as anything else, there was the wide disparity among business executives and the various parties involved as to what internal control really was all about. And bringing those disparate views together was a key to the project's success.
Let me just add a comment. Coopers & Lybrand spearheaded and was the author of this project. The advisory council did go through a formal RFP process in order to obtain the key heavy lifting author. And in doing that, I remember that Cooper's presentation was so impressive, and they were so committed to the dedication of resources to the project that it was so easy for the advisory council to conclude that Cooper's was the one that we wanted to engage. I mean, they made a wonderful contribution to the project, and it was clear from the beginning that that we had the benefit of a talented group of people, including Rick, on the project.
That were obviously committed for the long haul. Because, Rick, it was a multi-year kind of effort,
three-year project.
It was. We anticipated about a 12-month project, and it started in August of 1989 and ended in September of 92. So it stretched out a bit. Yeah.
And I think for purposes of history, I think it's helpful to get everybody to remember that in the late 80s, 89, we were dealing with the savings and loan crisis. So you've got the Treadway Commission coming in 87, followed by the S&L issues, sort of providing a backdrop to all this activity that I think is interesting. So, Dave, you know, today we think of COSO as COSO, or the very long name, the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations, but we refer to it on its acronym COSO. Was this sort of the transition from referring to everything as the Treadway Commission to now it's going to live beyond just that?
Yes, there really were two separate bodies, the Treadway Commission, the National Commission, et cetera, had one mission, and that was to provide the report that dealt with the concerns about the incidents of fraud and the recommendations. And it wasn't thought of something that would be ongoing. And then when the conclusion of the sponsoring organizations to respond to the recommendation about internal control, that's when COSO became COSO rather than the Treadway Commission. And there's a period of time here because the Treadway Commission, 85 to 87, and then as you mentioned, 89 through 92, was the first significant COSO project. And there was a thought at that point in time that there would be an ongoing oversight after the issuance of the report. So the Treadway Commission was a one-time deal. The COSO initiative with the internal control was thought of as something that there would be follow-on oversight after the issuance of the report.
So it wasn't a project-based – it wasn't a project team.
Well, it was both.
It had that,
but it was both,
designed
I
to
think.
Be beyond that.
Yes.
I got
gotcha.
You.
Also, Mark, you asked about how COSO came about. And in terms of the acronym, I've been asked many times how the acronym COSO came up. And I guess I personally need to take either the credit or the blame, however you phrase it. I remember when the COSO report was about to be printed, and I was involved in drafting a cover letter for the COSO board, I was thinking about an acronym and thinking about COSOT for Committee of Sponsoring Organizations of the Treadway Commission with a C at the end. I thought that was too long, so I shortened it to COSO. That's how it came about.
Well, you'll be humored by the – I got a question once. What is a COSO? It's not a car. Larry, can you give us a little perspective on the impact of that 92 framework in the 90s? We're going to get to the Sarbanes-Oxley period later, but for now, just how would you describe that early period of time after 92 when the framework was released and its sort of impact in the business community?
Okay, Mark, let me give it a shot.
Okay.
In terms of this. I think the impact was not as significant as we hoped it would have been. And in part because, as Rick pointed out, they did an amazing job starting with a fresh page. When we looked at internal control before that, we tended to look at transactions and segregation of duties. And all of a sudden, we see something that talks about the control environment, talks about risk, talks about control activities, about monitoring. All of those factors relating to objectives of better financial reporting all integrated into a framework. It took a while to get there. The importance of governance came through. The board, a really effective and independent audit committee has to be there. A commitment to ethical behavior. Things that auditors who were born accountants most of the time, looking at debits and credits and like structure, this appeared to be a little bit more unstructured than I think they were used to. But, and this maybe goes back to my bias of spending many years as an educator, it was picked up by all of the major auditing textbooks. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, students who became the next generation of auditors were familiar with the COSO framework. The elements of the cube, there's a reason there's three dimensions there. And understanding that if you have a weakness, which we found out in the savings and loans, we found out in equity funding before them, that tone at the top issue becomes really more and more important. And I found in discussions with audit partners at the time, they would say, we spend a lot more time just thinking and interviewing top management to find out where they are and what they're from and what those values are. So I think we developed the next generation, but we still had some struggles learning how to integrate the framework. And Rick and Dave, you may have some different views. You were in practice at that time, but that was my take of the 90s.
Well, let me just go back to the time it was issued and my perspective as an advisory council member, and that was that some of us were – first of all, we were very proud of the product, as you would expect, and, of course, Coopers and Lybrands as well. But I think we were worried that, gee, would this be something that people would embrace and then it would be put on the shelf and people would not really look at it? And so there was initially a concern about that. Now, I think the points that you raise are important, Larry, in terms of the fact that it was embedded. The concepts of the framework were embedded in a lot of other literature that was very helpful to us, including academic textbooks and training, and Auditing Standards Board embraced it. But there was a little bit of an uneasiness at first about, gee, we've done this work. you know, now is it going to be embraced? Or even if somebody says, yeah, that's a good product, is it something they'll say it's a good product but put on the shelf? Or is it something that's a good product that really will have an impact?
Mm-hmm. And it became a little bit, but it's sort of like behind the scenes embedding into some regulations. Some of the regulators here in Washington, you began to see it in the Yellow Book, those kinds of things.
Right.
I think it was very helpful. But it was happening, but maybe not, you know, on the marquee kind of thing. So that was part of it. So, Rick, we talked a little bit. Dave mentioned the selection of Coopers to provide some of the heavy lifting. Could you give us a little bit more detail of what that looked like and sort of Cooper's role in the process?
Sure, Mark. The Cooper's role, the project team's role, was really to design, develop, and write the framework. And part of our role was, as noted a bit earlier, to obtain information, input from many other participants. And in so doing, this is really an important part of it, to gain broad-based acceptance of the ultimate framework. So the process that we went through was designed to gain that acceptance at the end of the day. As to why we decided to take on this assignment, I think you asked me that, didn't you?
Yes.
I thought so. And to make a major financial investment, frankly, Coopers & Lybrand always considered itself a leader in the profession. And we saw that opportunity to continue in that role. We knew there was increasing interest, as Dave pointed out, in the subject of internal control, and Larry did also, and recognize that the resulting output would be widely viewed and might become akin to a standard on the subject. That was how we entered this project. And we saw our role as utilizing our existing experience on the subject. We knew from the outset what the categories of objectives, control objectives, would be. We had those in our proposal, actually. And we stayed with the operations, financial reporting, and compliance. We certainly had other thoughts on how the framework might shape up, but virtually all the other concepts were developed during the course of the project. And I'd like to just say one more thing here. The Coopers project team also kept in mind that we had the role of being the framework's authors. That is, while the COSO board and advisory council provided invaluable guidance, the Coopers team really made the final decisions in what the framework said. Subject, of course, to an ultimate decision by the COSO board on whether or not to accept the final report.
In that final report, there are some visuals. One visual that many people now know, if they're in a publicly traded company, is the COSO cube. Can you give us a little sense, Rick, on the cube diagram and the categories of objectives and how that came about?
Well, I've had dreams about that cube and sometimes nightmares. What happened really was that a meeting of the advisory council and the CNL project team, it was towards the end of the project, an advisory council member, all you know him, Andy Bailey, asked me or said first that he understood the three categories of objectives, understood the five components, and that internal control applies to any part of a business. But how, he asked, do these three elements work together? How do they interrelate? And very frankly, I had no clue at the time. But by the time I walked up to a flip chart in the corner of the room and picked up a marker, it kind of came together magically. I was always interested in architecture. I'm not going down a sideline here. And I, as a component of a course I had, there was a mechanical drawing segment. So I knew how to draw a three-dimensional item. And so I drew a three-dimensional cube on the chart. And I put at the top the three categories of objectives, down the front the components, on the side the parts of the business. I said, this is how the elements interrelate. And Dave is smiling now because the advisory council huddled up at the end of the conference table for about a minute or two. And Chairman Galen Larson then said, Rick, if you put that cube in the report, we will recommend to the COSO board that the report be accepted.
But one of the beauties that I think the Cube illustrates is really the simplification of the organization of the framework that was provided by Coopers. I mean, it wasn't something that was so complex that you couldn't show that interrelationship. There's three fundamental objectives. There's five components. There's the segments of a business that are three dimensions, and the ability to put those together in a cube is something that I think shows the power of the framework being effective, coordinated, but on the other hand, not overly complex.
Well, I can tell you from an academic perspective, it provides a great teaching tool to give that big picture, just as you're describing, to be able to do that. So we've talked about the launch of the framework in 92 and just sort of its embrace through the 90s, and then 10 years goes by, and we're 2001, early 2002. The financial reporting community experienced two of the largest financial statement frauds in history with the unraveling of Enron and then WorldCom. Enron in October of 2001, WorldCom June 2002. Soon after that, then Congress quickly passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in July of 2002, which contained a number of requirements, including the Section 404 requirements for management assertion and then auditor attestation about internal controls over financial reporting. Larry, can you give us a sense for how the passage of the Act, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act specifically, impacted the significance of COSO as a thought leader in internal control?
I'll try. Give this. First, it helped to have the public reporting on internal control mandated. And the most comprehensive framework that existed was the COSO framework. So there became a recognition that this must be pretty well developed and thought out. Second, as we have gone over a period of time, the internal control in our organizations have become much better. There were many deficiencies. If you look at the research reports that came out in 2004, 2005, a lot of companies who thought they had pretty good internal controls did not. And people kept saying, boy, we see the weaknesses now that we've never seen before. So I think that was a major part of it. I think the other part, maybe not everybody went back to the original Treadway Commission to look at their recommendations, but their recommendations that were made back in 87 pretty much paralleled what went into the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. The issues about public reporting on internal control over financial reporting, the issues related to the tone at the top, the ethical commitment, again, stronger audit committees, all became entrenched. The idea that risk relates to objectives, and that we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but COSO turned this around, that it all started with objectives, and there are risks to achieving those objectives and controls to mitigate it. I think people recognized it, and as we went into the revision in 2013, they saw that the framework, you know, the outline of the body, was still solid after 20 years, even though technology and business had changed dramatically. And I think that combination of things, COSO earned the respect it has in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Rick, I know you've had a lot of accomplishments over your career, but I would think looking at your work in 92 and then fast-forwarding to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, when you think about what if the framework had not existed when SOX was issued, what would that look like?
That's a great question, and of course we can't be sure. I'd say we'll never know, but one might think that Section 404 might never have been included in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And I say that because we'll remember that the SEC had proposed management reporting on internal control effectiveness a couple of times before, in 1979, again in 1988, but never issued final rules, in part because the comments that came back referred to cost, but also that there was no clear roadmap of what constituted effective, in quotes, effective internal control. That is, it was argued that without a basis for measuring a company's system of internal control against an accepted standard or baseline, it would not have been possible, really, to reasonably report on internal control effectiveness. Now, the COSO board, the advisory council, and Coopers and Lybrand certainly knew this history when embarking on the project. And as mentioned earlier, the primary purpose of this was to provide a framework that would help organizations enhance their internal control systems and gain the associated benefits, and there are many. But we frankly had in the back of our minds the need to provide a basis for reporting in the event that the SEC or Congress decided down the road on such a requirement.
Interesting.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting, the SOX 404 provision doesn't specifically allude to COSO as being the basis, the baseline to measure. It just says they need there needs to be a baseline that meets certain criteria that the SEC and SOX said were suitability criteria. And it's to COSO's credit and the credit of the framework that really about 99% of registrants use the COSO framework as their baseline for measurement of the effectiveness of controls. So even though it wasn't explicitly mentioned in the SEC regulations supporting SOX 404, people look to the the COSO framework as the baseline to measure effectiveness.
Which is, you know, the vision that you had in 92 to be preparing for that future event, now coming to reality, was tremendous when you think about that. Larry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I think Rick was going back to a lot of the comment letters that the SEC received where there was a perception not only of the cost, but that it would not add much value. And certainly over the past decade, we have seen that the cost can be managed effectively. It's a good business. And most of the firms with good internal control have done very well in the marketplace, whereas those with poor controls have not.
And as most of us know, I'll just add this, both the registrants, the CFOs, and the external auditors were frankly concerned about potential liability of stating, making a statement about internal control effectiveness without any standard to measure it against.
Yeah. So obviously the framework was a tremendous foundation to be able to comply with 404, but that didn't mean it was easy, as most public companies will tell us and their auditors. But when you think about the early years of implementation, Larry, I know you were, I think, chairing the board by this point where the implementation of 404 is occurring. There were some challenges, particularly being voiced from the smaller business community about the application of the framework to a small business context. And then there was also some confusion, I guess I'd say, over the monitoring component, that specific element of the five that people were maybe misinterpreting and
yes.
applying. Can you give us some sense for some of those issues and then how COSO tried to address that?
Okay. You're right. I was chair at the time, and we had some discussions even here at the SEC about small businesses and a question – can we develop a COSO light? And as we thought through that process, I certainly came to the conclusion, and the board did at that time, that there wasn't a COSO light. There is effective internal controls, and there's non-effective internal controls. But when we looked at the overall COSO internal control framework, we found, as you stated earlier, basic principles in the framework. And we found that small businesses could meet those principles. There might be some differences in how they document it. There might be some differences in how they implement a particular control. Or they may have a different control than you'd find in a larger business, but it mitigated the effect of risk. So as we went through that process, and I remember sitting down with the this time it was a PwC project team.
It was Miles Everson heading that.
With Miles Everson and Frank Martins was a major player in that. Setting in Chicago after, if you remember, we had this one conference and people talked about small business. And I stayed next day to work with the team. And they were discussing things and it just wasn't gelling. And it was either Frank or I or together said, why don't we take a look at this from a – just lay out the principles. And we started a principles approach, which you see now in the Coastal 2013. We had a few more than they have now, but we worked that down. And then we said, if we understand the principles, let's understand what are the key elements, like attributes. And so we had a principle on ethics, and we said, what's the key attributes? Well, you've got to codify your culture, your ethical culture. You got to communicate it. You got to determine if there's a way to determine there's lack of adherence, and you got to address those. That may take place differently in a small organization than a big organization, and it might focus a lot more on the work of the small business owner. But we laid out those principles, and they work. They work very well. The feedback we got was that they worked very well. Rick, you want to
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Yeah, that was, I think, very, very important on a number of levels. Essentially, that principles and attributes approach served as the foundation for the 2013 update to the internal control framework. So that was a starting point. I guess I'm like a bad penny. My name keeps turning up. I was asked by the PwC team doing the small business guidance to help them, and I think they did a great job in making sure all of the principles in the 92 framework were, in fact, included in that small business guidance.
It was. And then as we went from there, you asked the question about monitoring.
Right.
Well, one of the questions that came up with small businesses is, can I sit here as the CEO of this small business and read a report and say, I've effectively monitored my internal controls? And we thought it wasn't quite that easy, even with very knowledgeable CEOs. As an aside, we also addressed the issue of how much you have to document, that small businesses can document things slightly differently, but they need to show that the principles are there and working. So the other thing we know about monitoring, and this is sort of one of my pet areas, is that we want to make internal controls more cost-effective for every organization. And as now we're going into this era of more digital everything, we need more monitoring. And so we needed to take that component of the internal control framework and dive deeper into it. In this case, Trent Gasaway of Grant Thornton led that project, and again, very conceptually oriented. But then once we did it, we understood how they all fit together and what constitutes effective monitoring. And I think still today, a lot of organizations are working on monitoring. The other thing we did that's not in the 2013, but to help explain things in the small business and in the monitoring, we had kind of a flow diagram to understand how things fit together, that you start with objectives. There's risk to those objectives. There are control activities to mitigate the risk. There's effective communication going back and forth. All of that needs to be monitored, so they're all simultaneously working. And so you change internal control from sort of a once-a-year thing you do for SOX to an ongoing process. And that's what good companies, all organizations need. That was the intent of the monitoring document.
And I think it's important for us to clarify that these were more how-to guidance, that the 92 framework was still in play. It wasn't a new framework kind of thing.
Yeah, we did not change any of those elements. It really was kind of diving one level deeper to lay out the principles and then the attributes, which personally I really like. It just flows very well.
One interesting point, it was early on a recognition of the importance of monitoring, that today when you think of the business community and the focus on analytics and you think of the focus on big data, you know, the opportunity have exploded. But here you have a baseline that we've developed in the monitoring guidance that's very helpful in applying what today is advanced technology that allows you to be more robust in the area.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, several times we've referred to the 2013 revision. So, Dave, you were chairing at this point. So can you give us a little perspective? I know we don't have time to – we could do a whole hour on that, I'm sure. But a little of the perspective of what led to the revision, which was at its COSO's 20th anniversary of the 92 framework. What was the main driver of it?
First of all, our board spent a number of hours talking about a strategy for the revision and whether there needed to be a revision, because most of the COSO board members thought that the 92 framework continued to be an effective framework. You know, having it be principles-based and on concepts that really are timeless, you know, there wasn't a concern that you would be revising something that was defective. It was a concern about, gee, is there an opportunity to further enhance something that's already effective? So the board concluded that, yes, 20 years later, it's time to do that. And we had three objectives from the start. And again, with the help of PwC, the successor firm of Cooper's, in fact, we were very comfortable that we would continue to get the support of PwC. And with their leadership again, we had three fundamental objectives that we wanted to accomplish that I think were well accomplished. The first was to update the context of the document. If you think back in 1992, you know, we didn't have email. We in technology, we really didn't hardly have the internet. Business was not as complex in a number of areas. There wasn't nearly as much outsourcing, which affects internal control and how you look at internal control. Governance had developed, as Rick would know, and the importance of the board and the importance of audit committee. So there were a number of things in the context that we wanted to weave into the addition to make it, in effect, a 2013 as opposed to a 1992 context. The second thing, and it was based on the experience that we had with the small business document that Larry mentioned, and that is we wanted to make the principles, which were really implicit in the document, we wanted to make them explicit. So supporting the five components now are 17 principles and a number of what we now call points of focus that were in the small business attributes, but that's just a name change, really, that support the principles. But the fact that we wanted to make the document explicit in terms of the principles that support the components, and we thought that would add significantly to the understandability of the framework. And I think history already has shown that was a wise move. And again, we had comfort because it already was something that was really founded in the small business document. And finally, we wanted to broaden the emphasis in the discussion of the objectives. And Rick mentioned the three objectives being compliance, operations, and financial reporting. We wanted first to add a little more emphasis on the opportunity to look at internal controls through all three of those objectives, and not just financial reporting. And let me back up a minute. You know, SOX was very helpful in providing visibility to the framework, but it did so in terms of effectiveness over the objective of financial reporting, where we thought, gee, the real opportunities of the framework go much more broad than that to deal with compliance and operations as well. So we wanted to get more of that flavor into the document, and we did a number of things to accomplish that. But, for example, just to make it clear, we changed financial reporting objective to just reporting. So the result is the emphasis on that it really covers non-financial reporting as well as financial reporting, and it covers external and internal reporting, so not just external financial reporting. So those are three objectives that we focused on, the first being updating the context, making the principles explicit, and broadening the emphasis on the objectives.
So far we've started with the focus on fraudulent financial reporting with the Treadway Commission, and that led us to the conversation about COSO's focus and work in internal control. We want to move into that third leg of COSO's area of focus, and that is enterprise risk management. And in 2004, COSO issued its Enterprise Risk Management Integrated Framework, so now we're almost 11 years beyond that. Larry, can you give us a little color on why COSO decided to go off – to go down the path of developing a framework on enterprise risk management in addition to the framework already existing on internal control?
I think there are a couple of major reasons, Mark. One is risk is a part of the internal control framework that we began with. But at that point in time, with all of the context that you've helped give us earlier today, there was a lot of risk in business. There was a lot of literature about risk and risk management, but there was no common literature. There was no integration of that literature. And everything that existed in that literature started with risk. It did not start with objectives. And that's one of the major things that, Rick, Miles Everson, Frank Martins helped us understand, is that it always starts with objectives. And there's a need to get out of these so-called silos or little independent parts of the organization to look at enterprise risk management throughout the organization. We also tried to force managers to make some decisions about how much risk and what type of risk are they willing to take. And we introduced new terms that people have had trouble dealing with. But conceptually, if you think about it, risk appetite. Mm-hmm. How much risk are you willing to take? Or risk tolerances, what's the variation that you're willing to deal with around your risk appetite? Concepts that organizations need to start talking about or needed to start talking about if they're going to mitigate the risk, and keeping in mind where that project came out with, it's not about the risk primarily. It's about achieving your objectives and understanding there are risks that are going to be there between you and your objectives, and you got to figure out how to deal with them, how to manage them or move on with them. So that was the reason.
Rick, I know you get this question probably a lot. I know I have. You've got the COSO internal control framework. You've got the COSO ERM framework. So I think one of the things I want to make sure our listeners hear is they are two frameworks, but they're very related. Can you help us sort of see that relationship between the two?
Mark, you're right on both counts, and I do get this question very, very often. And the answer, very simply, is that the ERM framework, ERM, is broader than internal control. Period. End of sentence. I'll add to that a little bit. Internal control, of course, is an integral part of enterprise risk management and is encompassed within it. Now, as we go down a little deeper, the internal control framework has three categories of objectives. ERM has four. Internal control has five components. ERM has nine. As Larry said, to have effective ERM, a company needs to set risk tolerances and has to align them with an overall risk appetite. It also needs to take a portfolio view, that is, to consider risk from an overall broad-based perspective. So there's a much fuller consideration of risk in ERM. As we developed the ERM framework, it was really deemed important, though, to retain the internal control framework for its continued use in reporting, especially under SOX 404. So overall, while there's great overlap between the two, ERM has a much more robust focus on risk.
Dave, go ahead.
Let me just add, to your point about ERM being broader, which I totally agree with. One of the ways I think of it, and this is somewhat pragmatically, but I think of controls as being one-sided, always reducing the risk, whereas ERM recognizes that there are alternatives in dealing with the risk that provide opportunities to the company on an upside as opposed to the control downside managing of the risk.
And good point, David, a really good point. And the framework talks about the relationship of going back into strategy, that there may be risks you want to take and need to take.
David, I know the framework was out in 2004, but then COSO was pretty active after that, issuing some other guidance related to ERM. Do you want to touch on that?
Well, since that time, we've issued 11 or 12 thought papers that deal with the challenges of implementing ERM. And let me just say that we recognized in some surveys, including surveys that you spearheaded for us, that there is uneven application and implementation of ERM in the business community. And some people who might say they have a risk management or ERM program, it's not very robust. And so we were anxious to help companies move up the maturity curve, so to speak, in terms of their effectiveness in implementing ERM. And so we would issue or engage authors to issue, help us issue thought papers that dealt with subjects that were difficult subjects. So, for example, Larry spearheaded as a lead author of a thought paper that dealt with risk appetite, which is a difficult issue to implement. And you were very effective in terms of your thought papers that dealt with the relationship of risk management ERM to the board and how the board deals with ERM in their oversight role. So these are implementation issues that we thought were important in our goal of helping companies become more robust in their implementation of ERM.
Yeah, if I might just add to that, I think these thought papers have done a great job in another way as well, and that is to help to reinforce the idea that not every risk management function in a company or not every risk management process rises to the level of enterprise risk management. And I think a lot of observers out there still equate the two almost synonymously, and certainly these papers help to get the point across that they're not.
I think it's important for us to point out right now, COSO is in the process of looking at revision of that framework, updating, I guess, similar to the 2013 internal control. So that's ongoing today.
Yes.
We also started with the topic of fraudulent financial reporting in the context of the Treadway Commission's report, and I think it's important for us to at least make sure we don't overlook the work that COSO did in the area of research on the topic of fraudulent financial reporting. Dave,
well,
were you going to say something?
Yeah, Mark.
Okay.
This is one where take your moderator hat on, and we recognize that you were the key author of two research papers important to COSO that dealt with research in fraudulent financial reporting. So give us a thumbnail sketch of those two papers.
I'll give a quick thumbnail sketch, and then I just want to make sure we save a little time for some future thoughts. But the high-level view, in 99, we were asked by COSO to look at enforcement actions issued by the SEC alleging fraudulent financial reporting over an 11-year period. And so we looked through the enforcement actions to try to understand what are the common sort of themes, techniques to engage in fraud, and to try to get a sense for the context surrounding the cases investigated by the SEC. And we issued the monograph in 99 to really provide a more, it's not with the full population, but a large number sample size of those cases to better understand, when you look at it at an aggregate level, what's going on here? What's the nature of the fraud? And then that was updated again with a more extensive study in 2010 to catch us up for that next 10 years. And what was interesting, I think, between the two is just seeing the improvements in board structure. A lot had happened in the governance space, such that we really didn't see much difference between some of the governance issues between fraud and no-fraud firms that we might have seen in the early 90s and 80s. Just to move on to our last topic, I do want to make sure with the three of you in this room to touch on this for a minute. We've talked all about the history of COSO, but it would be not wise on our part to not get your thoughts on the future of COSO, and you've all played major roles in this. We've looked at the last 30 years, but let's spend just a second looking at the next 30 years. If you think about, you know, looking ahead, how would you envision the role of COSO over the next 30 years? And, Rick, I'll get you to provide your thoughts on that.
Sure. I'll start us off. As we take a look at COSO's mission, we see its goal, and this is almost a quote, to provide thought leadership on enterprise risk management, internal control, and fraud deterrence designed to improve organizational performance and governance and to reduce the extent of fraud. Now, that's quite broad. I expect COSO to continue to be in the forefront of those areas, maintaining the frameworks and providing more guidance to business, including senior managements and boards of directors. We've seen a great deal of focus recently, especially on boards of directors in the financial media. And it certainly would not surprise me if the COSO board decided to move forward on the topic of corporate governance. focusing on such things as the responsibilities of boards of directors and how they can best carry those out and enhance their performance. So, and I being a bit of a fly on the wall, I understand the COSO board, hope I'm not talking out of school here, has had some discussions on this topic, and I would think personally that a natural outgrowth consistent with its mission would be to move forward with a framework on the subject of corporate governance effectiveness.
Dave, were you going to say something?
Well, I agree with all of Rick said. First of all, I personally just I want to say I'm biased, but I love our mission. And I love our mission because it deals with controls, risk, and fraud in a way that when you deal with those effectively, it's so important to the success of organizations. So it makes us feel good that they're topics that we really believe are important to the success of organizations. I think governance is very consistent with that, and having a framework on governance that's sort of an umbrella would certainly be something that the board would consider in the future.
If I might add just a couple of things here, Mark, I'm not sure that we're in the best position to do a framework on governance. But I think one of the things that COSO is going to have to think about over the next 30 years is whether to expand and diversify its membership. For example, if we bring in the National Association of Corporate Directors as one of our representatives so that we're more than five organizations that are primarily viewed as accounting organizations, then we're in a better position to do that. I think that as we go forward, where David has led us with more implementation guidance is a big thing. I think the board will eventually have to make a decision of whether or not it has any paid staff to do all of this. We've done a wonderful job as volunteers. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to recognize the commitment that organizations have made to support it. But I think the issue of diversifying and bringing in more membership may lead us to a better position to become the thought leader on those areas as well.
Dave, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you see a more formalized structure at some point?
Well, I don't like the word formalized in the sense that I don't want to suggest that we become a standard setter. I like the idea of being a thought leader because I think when you're a thought leader, you're not as constrained in terms of looking provocatively at leading edge kinds of things that might be helpful. Whereas if you're a standard setter, there is that constraint. So I like the idea that COSO continues to not be so formal that they really can throw out ideas in a thought leader fashion. I will say, by the way, that Bob Hirth, our current chair, I think is doing a wonderful job with the board in looking to the future and moving COSO to the next level. And he works very hard, free of charge, to do that. And I think that, to your point, at some point in time, maybe we need a paid staff. I will say that Bob works his tail off in a way that's very effective in moving us forward in ways that are important. Certainly globally, he's been all over the world. He's thinking about training, certification, issues that deal with implementation, and I'm very comfortable with his leadership.
Which 30 seconds here, Larry. You know, COSO is pretty much a U.S.-based representation. Do you see a more global footprint at some point?
I do. The question is how to get there and still have it COSO. I've worked with China. I've worked with Japan. I like Bob, many. There's thirst for COSO. We just need to steer our way there. So I hope I made the 30 seconds.
It is surprising globally today what a footprint we have. I mean, the frameworks are already translated into eight or nine languages and used in several countries.
Well, gentlemen, we are approaching the end of our broadcast. Dave and Larry, Rick, it's been a real pleasure for me being with you again first, but I just appreciate the time you've taken to provide this excellent discussion today. Today's broadcast will be available in audio MP3 format in the virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. An edited transcript will be added later. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank again COSO, the American Accounting Association, the American Institute of CPAs, Financial Executives International, the Association of Accountants and Financial Professionals in Business, and the Institute of Internal Auditors, and particularly Bob Hirth, for their generous commitment and assistance in making today's program possible. Thank you for joining with us today, and good afternoon.